Good morning. Thank you very much for coming. I'm going to speak in English. It's a great pleasure to be here. I have a number of slides, to indicate a change in the slide, as I need to communicate that to Fabrice, I'll just raise my hand like that. Okay, Fabrice? Okay, so second slide, please. The questions I'm going to address in this talk are these. Very briefly, the governing context, the relationship between Britain and Ireland in 1845. I want to say something about what government could have done, about the potentiality of government policy, the agencies that were available to government in the time. A little bit about expectations, what people believed government should do in response to this food crisis. Then I want to outline the policies of the two governments in power between 1845 and 1852, what they actually did, and then conclude by saying something about the motivations, the ideologies that lying behind government policy and the external constraints, a little bit about the genocide debate, although perhaps we can come back to that in questions. So, Fabrice. So, Ireland is not a self-governing territory. It has a history of a colonial relationship going back to the 12th century with England, the English state, later the British state, which is formed in the 16th century. But by the 19th century, it has a hybrid constitutional relationship. It is part of the colonial metropolis through the incorporation of Ireland into the United Kingdom in the 1800 Act of Union, which comes into effect in 1801. So in theory, Ireland is part of a unitary United Kingdom state. It has representation in the British Parliament, with 105 MPs and 32 peers. That's about one in seven of all the MPs in the House of Commons are elected from Ireland. But until 1829, Catholics, the majority population, were excluded from sitting in Parliament. And even after 1829, when the great breakthrough campaign for Catholic emancipation succeeds, most of the MPs remain landed or from landed families, and most of them, although not all of them, are Protestant because of the property qualifications that exist for election. So Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, but it has a separate government to the rest of the United Kingdom. It has an executive in Dublin Castle, appointed by the British Prime Minister, headed by a Lord Lieutenant. And it's the only part of the United Kingdom that has this kind of separate governance. So there's a kind of colonial legacy there. So there's a Lord Lieutenant, a Chief Secretary, who's the kind of executive minister of the Irish government, and an Undersecretary, who is the kind of head of the day-to-day administration. Ireland often has its own legislations, and this is true of Scotland as well, actually. So there's a unitary state, the United Kingdom, of Great Britain and Ireland, but there is separate legislation passed in the Parliament for Ireland. And Ireland retains in many ways a different administrative structure to that of the rest of the United Kingdom. And of course, Ireland is distinguished by having a very active nationalist movement, emerging as a mass movement in the 1810s and 1820s under the leadership of Daniel O'Connell, initially demanding Catholic emancipation from 1830, moving on to demanding repeal of the Union, to a return to Irish self-government within some kind of looser constitutional connection with the United Kingdom. Okay, so what agencies existed for the British government to use in response to a social crisis of the nature of the Great Famine? Well, it's worth remembering that the Great Famine of the 1840s is not the first Great Famine in Irish history. Go back a century to 1739, 1740, 1741. There is another Great Famine in mid-18th century Ireland, which kills proportionately as many people as the Great Famine of the 1840s in a shorter period of time. Arguably, it's actually a worse famine than the Great Famine of the 1840s. At that time, in the early 18th century, there are virtually no state agencies available to act effectively in preventing famine. By the mid-19th century, however, things have changed. So we have a number of agencies created in the first half of the 19th century which increase the state's knowledge of social conditions and which potentially allow the state to intervene more effectively. The Commissariat is the supply department of the British Army, which is established initially to feed and provision the British Army on campaign. But in peacetime, after 1815, is frequently deployed to deal with civil emergencies as well. So by the early 1840s, the state has a military department which can provide food, if the political will is there, through establishing food depots. And we'll see that is put into place during the Great Famine. In the 1820s, the state starts to enumerate effectively the population of Ireland. There's a census commission established in 1821 that carries out a census of the people of Ireland. And they're increasingly, on a 10-year cycle, adds more and more detail. So by the 1841, it's collecting information about employment patterns, about housing standards, language, about education levels. So the state is increasingly gathering information about its people. It's mapping the country as well. From 1824, the state maps Ireland minutely through the Ordnance Survey. In the 1830s, the state starts to intervene in a coherent way in developing the infrastructure of Ireland through the Board of Works. This is a state body set up to build roads, to build harbours, also provide assistance to landowners in improving their land. It also interferes in education. In 1831, in Ireland, and again, these things aren't happening in England, only in Ireland. In 1831, the state creates a National Education Board, which takes responsibility for building, staffing, and funding the mass elementary education of the population. In 1836, an Irish constabulary is established. There had been police forces before that in Ireland, but in 1836, this is a unified, centralised national police force, a kind of gendarmerie, very different from what's happening in England, under direct state control rather than under local control. Again, which is used to collect information for the census, to provide agricultural reports. So again, the police force not only keep order, but are the eyes and the ears of the state. And in 1838, for the first time in Irish history, a national poor law is introduced. So that creates, if you like, at least an elementary welfare infrastructure through establishing 130 poor law unions, each with their own workhouse, with their own dispensary, and subsequently fever hospitals attached as well. So Ireland has this quite elaborate state, in many ways quite distinct from what's happening in England, which is still much more laissez-faire. But the financial control lies in London. So while the Irish government has a lot of control over what these agencies do, it is entirely dependent on financial transfers from the Treasury in London to make these agencies work. And this proves to be a highly problematic relationship during the Great Famine itself. So Fabrice, if we can have the next slide. Expectations of state action also increase in the early 19th century, as I said. In the mid-18th century, there's very little expectation. It's assumed that landowners or the clergy will take action, if there is any, to relieve famine. But by the early 19th century, the state is starting to put some of these agencies into operation. There's a regional famine crisis in Ireland in 1816, 1817, which sees the state starting to put some of its kind of the preliminary forms of these agencies into operation. So Robert Peel, who was Prime Minister during the Great Famine, had been Chief Secretary for Ireland in 1816 to 17, and had been Home Secretary, the Minister of the Interior, if you like, in 1822, when there was another regional famine in Ireland. So British ministers, particularly Peel, have experience of dealing with Irish food crises and have experience in utilising elements of the state to establish public works regimes and also to, in some cases, to import food. The other main British party, Peel, is a Conservative. The other main British party is the Whig Party. Its ministers also acquire experience in dealing with small-scale regional famines in the 1830s. And there's a kind of an established pattern by the 1830s of what the state does to deal with a regional famine. It encourages landowners to work with it in establishing public works. Sometimes they bring in food to start to release through depots, local depots. And this is directed by the administration in Dublin Castle. But what's different between these interventions and the Great Famine is the scale. These are small scale and they can be done without really major increase in the budget. They can be contained within the annual budget of the Irish administration. Okay, for the next slide. So I'm going to move on to talk about what happens during the Great Famine. And there are four different types of ways in which the state can intervene. I'm just identifying these to help us conceptualise this. First, the state can intervene in the realm of food availability and food price. It can do that by either importing food or preventing the export of food. And it can either impose direct price controls or indirect price manipulation through importing food and releasing it into the market. So that's the first area where the state might be able to intervene. Second is employment and providing wages to those who are out of employment, who cannot find paid employment through state mechanisms. Third area is direct aid, by providing direct food assistance, rations, to individuals, by providing shelter and providing medical aid. And the fourth area of assistance might be to assist people to emigrate, assisted emigration. So those are kind of four areas. So let's look at what the two governments actually do in terms of these categories of intervention. So the first government to deal with the famine crisis is that of Sir Robert Peel, the Conservative Prime Minister. There he is, 1788 to 1850. Who's in power from 1841 through until the summer of 1846. Now, it's important to remember this government faces a relatively, let's not say minor, but a moderate food crisis. Ireland has the ability within its agricultural system to survive one year of potato failure, of subsistence crop failure, because of kind of the insurance elements that exist in the peasant economy, the pig that can be sold, the goods that can be pawned, the assistance that can be sought from neighbours and relatives. So this government is dealing with a moderate crisis rather than an extreme crisis. It's also very keen not to concede political ground to Daniel O'Connell. It's been trying to wrest moderate, particularly clerical Catholic opinion, away from supporting O'Connell's nationalist movements. It's been making concessions to the Catholic Church, greatly increasing the subsidy to the Catholic seminary at Maynooth in 1845, for example. But it's worried that the O'Connell movement will use the threat of famine to attack the British government and to lead to a further upsurge in repeal agitation. You know, so there's a kind of political consideration in determining how it responds. But its response is also very tied in complex ways to the major British political question of the day, which is the Corn Laws, the legislation that protects British agriculture through a system of tariffs. Peel wants to abolish the British Corn Laws, and he regards the potato crisis in Ireland as both an opportunity, as a food crisis, to push through that reform, but also as an inducement, a genuine inducement to stimulate food import into Ireland in the long term, to replace at least partially the potato. Okay, there are political constraints on this government. It splits over the Corn Law issue. Its right wing breaks with Peel early in 1846 and becomes an independent party called the Protectionists. And it's worth remembering as well that Charles Trevelyan, who we'll come across again in just a minute, who is the chief civil servant, the assistant secretary to the Treasury in the British Treasury, is also in place during Peel's administration as well. So there are certain continuities between the two administrations. So let's look at what this government does. And food policy, I think quite in a very interventionist way, it buys in £100,000 worth of maize. Maize is the cheapest foodstuff that can be bought on the international market. It's low cost and it's produced in surplus in North America. So, but the government decides to buy it secretly so as not to upset the private markets. It imports this maize into Ireland, and it puts it into depots run by the Army Commissariat, which is given responsibility for managing the food supply. The aim is not to feed the people of Ireland in the wake of a potato failure, but to manage the market price of foodstuffs in the market by releasing this maize gradually when the prices start to rise. So it's a kind of price management policy rather than a direct feeding policy. They decide, however, not to interfere with exports, and this is a kind of key element of all British policy between 1845 and 1852, no intervention in the export, despite demands by Irish nationalists like Daniel O'Connell and the more radical nationalists that this must, that the export of grain from Ireland must be stopped. The grain produced in Ireland is not, for the most part, consumed in Ireland. It is exported to Britain. And Peel's government hopes in the long term that the repeal of the Corn Laws will stimulate a long-term import trade in maize into Ireland, that Ireland will continue to produce higher quality grains, wheat, oats for export to Britain, but it's the dependence on potato will be replaced by eating maize. The employment policy of this government is to set up public works. Now, that's a continuity from the 1810s and the 1820s. So it allocates funds for employment on roads and drainage works. It offers favourable terms to Irish landowners to take out loans to pay for this, supported by grants and aid from the state. It uses the Board of Works to create the infrastructure to organise these works. And it's criticised for its delay in setting up the works, but indeed it's put under pressure to put them into operation by a series of food riots and employment riots in the spring of 1846. But it does so in the wake of that pressure, and indeed Irish political pressure as well. And in terms of direct aid, the government seeks to work with the Irish local elites through establishing relief committees, which are voluntary bodies but regulated by the state. There's 650 of them established across the island, staffed by private individuals. But these are the organisations responsible for selecting those who should be given tickets to work on the public works and those who should be given any assistance with regard to free food. The government doesn't initially want to... The government initially wants to treat this as a one-off, one-year emergency response. It doesn't want any policies it passes in this year to be tied up with the extension of the Irish Poor Law. Okay, so what is it, how successful is this government? There's relatively low excess mortality in 1845-46. There's a containment of peasant insurgency, although there is an attempt to pass a coercion act in the summer of 1846. So the government is relatively successful in keeping mortality down, but it has to be remembered it is a moderate rather than a severe food crisis, and it doesn't have a contingency plan for what happens if the potato fails again. So we don't know what this government would have done had it survived beyond the summer of 1846. It may not have acted really in a tremendously different way from that of the succeeding government. So the succeeding government is headed by this man, Lord John Russell, leader of the Whig Party or the Whig Liberal Party, which historically had been much closer to Irish Catholics, had been in alliance with Daniel O'Connell. But this government faces a much more serious and prolonged crisis in Ireland with a second potato failure, nearly total potato failure in 1846, low harvest, small harvest in 1847, return of potato blight in 1848 and again in 1849. It also faces a British banking crisis, a financial crisis from the autumn of 1847, which puts tremendous pressure fiscally on what it can do. It has to deal with the impact of recession on Britain. It has to deal with revolution in Europe as well from 1848. So it's in a sense working in a much more difficult environment. It's a minority government. It doesn't have control over the House of Commons. It's dependent on support of Robert Peel and his supporters. It's also facing a kind of taxpayers' revolt from British middle-class radicals, particularly from 1848 onwards. Russell himself, while he's very well-meaning, is quite a weak prime minister. He's undermined by factionalism within his own party, and he's much more dependent on Charles Trevelyan, who now kind of comes into a much more prominent position as the expert on Irish famine policy. So what does this government do? Well, in terms of organisation, it drops the relief commission that Peel had established, and it moves away from any intervention in the food trade at all. So it abandons any new purchase of food or interference in the markets. Once the residual food left in the depots from the previous year run out, it's not replenished. So there's a reliance on market forces, which Trevelyan is very active in rationalising through quotations, sent to Irish administrators from Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, for example, adamant that, that free trade in food, complete free trade and reliance on market forces must be maintained. And arguably, this failure to interfere greatly enhances the acute crisis into which Ireland collapses in the winter of 1846-47, the hunger winter of 1846-47. However, it's worth remembering that, I'm not going to go through this chart in detail, but it's worth, this is an indication of the net exports and imports of Irish food between the normal pre-famine years, the first, sorry, I seem to have lost the years here, but the first, yeah, no, 1844. 1844 is a kind of normal year. Ireland exports a lot of food. The blue chart is the aggregate. 1845, it's still exporting a lot of food. The amount of food exported in 1846 is much smaller. And the yellow bar coming down below zero is the import of maize coming in from North America. But from 1847 onwards, Ireland is importing a lot more food than it's exporting. And that's because of the, there is a kind of free trade in food, bringing a lot of grain, particularly maize, into Ireland from 1847 onwards to North America. And the price of food collapses from the autumn of 1847. The problem is people can't afford to buy it. Okay, so, and that takes us on to the next policy. The government initially continues, there are three phases of government policy under Russell. Initially, it maintains Peel's employment policy. It continues public works as the principal mode of relief. It passes a new act in August 1846 called the Labour Rate Act, which raises additional money to put into public works projects. But in other ways, the policy becomes more regressive. So it's much less generous towards the Irish localities. Ireland can borrow money for works, but there's much less in the way of grant aid going to the Irish landlords. And crucially, the government insists that the work must be unproductive. It must, if you like, be useless work. It can't be infrastructurally developmental work, because that's the sort of thing landlords should be paying for themselves, not the British taxpayer. The British taxpayer provides employment only as a last resort to provide food, money to buy food to those who need it. So there's a kind of much more regressive attitude, penal attitude, towards what public works should be doing. There's a more penal attitude towards those working on the public works as well. Whereas previously people had been paid a flat rate for a day's work, from the autumn of 1846, piecework rates are brought in. In other words, people are paid by how much measurable work they do, which is good if you're young and fit and male, because you can earn towards the top of that scale if the scale is actually operating. But it's bad news if you're old, if you're female, if you're a child, or you're ill, and a lot of people are becoming very ill because you're forced down to the bottom of that scale for reasons outside your control, below the level at which you can earn enough food to feed yourself and your family. So the public works are starting to fail catastrophically as workers are unable to earn enough money to feed their family, although the numbers are going up and up and up. 700,000 people are working on the public works by March 1847. But the people are dying on the roadsides despite being employed. Initially, the government cuts back on direct relief. It cuts grant and aids to relief committees, and it puts more weight onto the Irish poor law. The workhouse numbers start to rise. Many of them are full and turning people away by late 1846. It's more reliant on charity. It looks to charity to fill the gap and promotes charity quite heavily through organisations like the British Association. Initially, also, it has a very limited response to the medical crisis, and it's not interested in assisted emigration. So in the first phase of policy, almost everything is put onto the public works, and the public works are failing in this catastrophic winter of 1846-47. Second phase, then, sees a major shift in policy. The government is highly embarrassed by hostile public commentary, by the publicised work of activist philanthropic agents like the Quakers, who not only set up their own food relief systems but publish critiques of what's happening in Ireland. And the government feels pressurised to change its policy as a consequence of the evident failure of what's happened in the winter of 1846-47. So it establishes a new agency called the Relief Commission, headed by this man, a military figure, Sir John Burgoyne. Now, it doesn't really make any changes to food policy. Again, it's still reliant on free trade. It decides to abolish the public works. And these were rapidly phased out from March 1847. And obviously they weren't working. The problem is, even though it's decided from February 1847 to replace the public works by feeding people directly, it doesn't have that feeding system set up until 2 or 3 months later. So there's a gap between the abolition of public works, and you see from this map the proportion of people employed in the public works, over 20% of the population in many of the western counties. These people are thrown out of work, but without the replacement relief system being anywhere near ready to deal with them. So we have another acute food crisis and mortality spike in the spring of 1847, promoted as well by the spread of highly infectious diseases. Okay, what it does do eventually is it shifts to a policy of direct relief. So the idea is now is that we must feed the people directly through giving them rations. And these are provided through what are called the soup kitchens. This experimentation in direct rationing had been pioneered by the Quakers, using their own philanthropic resources in the winter of 1846-47. The government passes an act in 1847 to roll this out as a state initiative. But there's lengthy bureaucratic and financial delays in setting up the system. It's not until June of 1847 it really comes into effect as a national policy. However, once it does come into effect, it actually proves remarkably effective. By July 1847, more than 3 million people are being fed daily at state expense through the soup kitchens. Now, they're not being fed very liberally, they're not being fed a large amount of food, but it's enough to keep people alive and it brings mortality down. It's also done relatively cheaply. It's much cheaper than the public works, and much more effective in getting relief to those who need it most, those in the greatest degree of destitution. The government accompanies this by a Temporary Fever Act, which also allows for the creation of emergency hospitals to deal with the fever epidemic. So in the summer of 1847, we see government policy, which had failed in the first phase, starting to have an impact in bringing mortality down. Scenes from the soup kitchens, these are from the Illustrated London News, it's the model soup kitchen set up in Dublin by the French chef, the celebrity French chef based in London, Alexis Soyer. People queuing for soup here, sketched by a middle-class lady in 1847, and the extent of people dependent on the soup kitchens, over 80% in these dark-coloured areas in the west of Ireland, and Mayo and Galway, Clare and West Cork and Kerry, much less in the east and in the northeast. Okay, so we move on to the third and final phase of government policy, and then I'll say a little bit about motivation and shut up. Okay, so the government arguably interferes relatively effectively, but then rapidly shifts policy again in the late summer and autumn of 1847. And this third phase runs through until the kind of end of famine conditions in 1850, 51, 52, depending on what part of Ireland you're talking about. In this last phase, responsibility is shifted away from the Relief Commission onto the Poor Law, which is enhanced and given additional powers in 1847. Food policy remains, again, minimalist, winding down whatever's left of the food depots, relying on the free market. There are a few small employment projects, there's some railway works established in 1847, but they're pretty small scale. Direct aid shifts from feeding people through soup kitchens to sending them to the workhouses to be relieved instead. And the argument behind this is that the famine is really over by the autumn of 1847. There's a good grain harvest. The potato blight has disappeared, at least temporarily, in 1847, even though there's very few potatoes planted. And the argument is that really this is a mopping up operation now, that Ireland needs to be forced to return to normality. If you continue to assist people for too long, after the most acute crisis is finished, they will become dependent on state assistance. So you need to force the people to go out and find work, and you need to force the landowners to provide employment, to borrow money and provide employment for the people that they're responsible for on their estates. So the idea is that the Poor Law will do this through local taxation. This is paid for through local taxation rather than through national state loans and grants as the previous relief initiatives had been. So the slogan becomes very much Irish property, the Irish landowners, must pay for Irish poverty through the mechanism of the poor law. And when this runs into difficulties, and this and lots of unions go bankrupt in 1848, the solution is not to transfer resources from Britain, but to tax the east and the north of Ireland through what's called the rate in aid, to pay for the continuing distress in the south and the west. Okay, so Ireland is regarded in this third phase as a separate entity to the rest of the United Kingdom, much to the outrage of many Irish commentators. And there are debates over assisted emigration, again, mostly through the poor law system. There's some small-scale assisted emigration schemes, taking workhouse girls, for example, to Australia, about 2,000 of them. But they're relatively, again, the free market is, the emigration is left to the free market. The scale of people being dependent on the poor law, you can see from that chart there, rising from relatively small numbers assisted, that's total relieved, the blue bars, in 1845, up to huge numbers, 900,000 plus people being relieved through the poor law mechanism in the course of 1849. That's an indication of the continuing scale of distress in these latter years of the famine, even though food is relatively cheap. People are being evicted, people are unable to find employment, they're thrown into these overcrowded and pestilential workhouses. Okay, so just very briefly on the poor law. So 130 of them, but they're swamped. And they're dependent on local rates, half the rates being paid by the landowner, and the landowner has to pay all the rates on very small properties rated under £4, which gives them an incentive to clear the tenants off those lands, so they don't have to pay for them anymore. So the poor law actually becomes a mechanism for promoting clearance. And indeed, the quarter acre clause introduced in the 1847 Amendment Act facilitates this. Anyone who occupies more than a quarter acre of land, so a relatively small plot, cannot receive relief under the poor law unless they give up their land to their landowner. Okay, so just to conclude then. So this policy is if we look at it as a whole, is clearly a failure. We've got 1.1 million excess deaths, mostly between 1846 and 1850, 1851. That's 1 in 8 of the island's population. This is a kind of massive excess death rate. Now, some of this, you know, arguably is outside the control of the government, but the policy interventions are clearly largely failures as well, with the exception of this summer 1847 soup kitchen regime. It's a failure to ensure adequate food supplies and the equitable distribution of food to those who needed it most. There's a false belief the famine is over by autumn 1847, which leads to a fatal shift in policy. There's a withdrawal from state responsibility in the latter stages of the famine, throwing it onto the localities. And there's a failure to introduce comprehensive measures, if you like, major employment schemes, developmental works or assisted emigration to relieve pressure from the poor law in the final stages. So why did it fail? Well, there are constraints. The Irish food crisis, which is very real, the international food shortage, particularly in the early stages of the famine, although that's fading from 1847, the political weaknesses of the government and parliament and its internal divisions, the British recession, which is crucially important, problems of agency in Ireland, problems of local corruption, administrative inefficiency, which we cannot exclude, and a lack of cooperation between Irish government and local elites. But the other factor is ideology, and there's evidence. There's no evidence for deliberate genocide, in my view anyway, although some people would argue there is, but I haven't found any evidence for deliberate intentionality in seeking to starve large numbers of people. However, it's quite clear there are many ideological forces lying behind much of this government policy. Laissez-faire, leaving the administration of relief to market forces is a key one. Providentialism, the idea that the famine has been sent by God for some beneficent purpose, is absolutely crucial to much of British thinking about the Great Famine. The idea that this has been divinely ordained, perhaps to force Ireland into helping itself, and this tends to be the most common mode of interpretation, that God intends Ireland to be transformed through this crisis. And this is inherent in the commentary of Charles Trevelyan himself on the Great Famine. Moralism, the idea that people, the problem in Ireland isn't that there isn't enough food, that there are too many people. The problem is people don't work hard enough, and they're too dependent on the state, too dependent on handouts. It's kind of very, liberal, neoliberal idea, which is still with us through to today. So you've got to force the Irish landlords and peasants themselves to help themselves. Racism is a factor. I don't think it's the predominant factor, but there's certainly a racist attitude towards the Irish in British public culture, manifest in newspapers like The Times, in the magazine Punch. It's less evident in British government commentary, but there is an underlying element of difference, of differencing the Irish as not English and protecting English interests in government policy. And then finally, a preoccupation with permanent improvements, with, if you like, forgetting about keeping people alive and focusing on transforming Irish society through to bring about a more efficient agricultural structure. And the final slide is just a kind of pictorial representation of that idea of moralism, which I think is absolutely, for me, the most important ideological factor. This is a Punch cartoon from spring 1849, and it's titled The New Irish Still, showing how all sorts of good things may be created by industry out of peat. It's a complete fantasy, but what we have here is the Irish labourer being forced to work, carrying the spade of industry, using the raw materials of Ireland, peat if you like, to provide the food and the prosperity that Ireland should have and which it will have in the future. So the idea is that Ireland isn't necessarily a basket case, but it is a society that is backward through the predominance of attitudes of dependency, of the failure of entrepreneurialism and the failure of work discipline. And if that problem can be addressed through policy making, Ireland can be transformed into a modern and dynamic capitalist agricultural economy. Okay, so thank you very much.